This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll speak with the executive director of the Pittsburgh Citizen Police Review Board. She'll give us a glimpse inside the internal conflicts over obtaining documents related to police conduct at the G20 summit last September. Is the U.S. becoming like China? We'll talk with Tracy Rosenberg, executive director of Media Alliance, about the proposed internet kill switch bill. Last week, the Supreme Court's decision in the Humanitarian Law Project case dealt a severe blow to civil liberties and the First Amendment rights of U.S. citizens. Will the actions of lawyers, journalists, and researchers now be called material support to terrorists? Stay with us. Past president of the National Lawyers Guild, Peter Erlander, returned home last Tuesday after spending nearly 3 weeks in a Rwandan prison for challenging the official version of that country's 1994 genocide. A lawyer at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, Erlander was arrested on May 28th, shortly after arriving there, to assist with the legal defense of an opposition presidential candidate. Critics of the Rwandan government say that the laws barring denial of the Rwandan genocide have been used to silence political opposition. Erlander was freed on medical grounds last week after being hospitalized 4 times since his arrest and receiving an outpouring of global support. Rwandan authorities have not, however, dropped their investigation. The 62-year-old Erlander is a professor at William Mitchell College of Law in St. Paul and was in Rwanda to help defend an opposition presidential candidate when he was arrested. He was not formally charged. Upon his return to Minnesota, Erlander said that the Rwandan capital, Kigali, looked much improved since his last trip there in 2004. He said that many world leaders have said Rwanda has changed for the better into a more democratic country, and that he, quote, made the mistake of believing them. He said that his imprisonment showed that Rwanda hasn't changed and compared the authorities there to the East German and Soviet secret police. Erlander said he had feared for his life from the first moments after his arrest in a Rwandan hotel, where he was alone having breakfast. He said he was taken away by 6, quote, burly guys, and he thought that they were going to disappear him, not arrest him. He credits being alive to the fact that he demanded that the embassy come to observe the search and believes that it was at that moment that the disappearance fell apart. Erlander cited a recent African press report chronicling a Rwandan government hit list that named opponents of President Paul Kagame, a list that included Erlander's name. As a defense attorney, Erlander had already been involved with Rwanda through the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, which the UN Security Council created to prosecute those accused of responsibility for the genocide. Pittsburgh City Council is worried that if the city's Citizen Police Review Board is allowed to scrutinize secret records of officer conduct compiled during last September's G20 economic summit, more protesters will sue and possibly jeopardize a $20 million liability insurance policy the city bought before the summit last year. Quote, "We could lose our homes over this," said City Councilman Teresa Smith, chairwoman of the Public Safety Committee. "If we don't have insurance, then it falls to us." The Seeds of Peace Collective and Three Rivers Climate Convergence have filed a joint federal lawsuit against the city, charging that police violated their First and 14th Amendment rights at 2 events during the G20. Meanwhile, City Hall has started the nomination process to remove most of the members of the Pittsburgh Citizen Police Review Board. We'll get more details about this from Elizabeth Pittenger, the executive director of the Pittsburgh Citizen Police Review Board. Welcome, Beth, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, I was surprised after many months following the G20 summit to read that you and your Citizen Police Review Board are back in the news again. This time, with not such happy news. As I understand it, your city council is concerned that records you are asking to be made public concerning police treatment of protesters at the G20, they're concerned that that may possibly interfere with an insurance policy that the city took out during the G20 summit.
That's correct. That seems to be what their concern is. While they did wisely ensure their performance during the event, it would appear that there's some concern about the due diligence that went into the preparation of that policy. They are worried that the board's intention to conduct a general inquiry will yield information to people that they have been quoted as saying they do not want to have the information.
As I understand it, right now there are two groups. One is the Seeds of Police Collective. The other, the Three Rivers Climate Convergence, have filed a joint federal lawsuit against the city, charging that police violated their constitutional rights at two events.
That's what we understand.
Is it also true that the review board has had some access to some of the heavily redacted police records?
Well, the board, the Citizen Police Review Board, does have subpoena power. And so when they initiated their inquiry last October, we had conducted a general request of a number of documents to be turned over so we could begin the inquiry. The city resisted providing that information. And in December, the chairperson of the Citizen Police Review Board issued a subpoena demanding that a number of police reports specified by number be turned over in addition to operational material and documents, and the city resisted doing that. So the board filed a motion with the Court of Common Pleas to enforce their subpoena. And on March 18th, the court issued an order directing the city to provide the documents that were identified on the subpoena. The order was issued on March 18th, and since then, we attempted to resolve the matter to get the information we needed. They finally gave us a stack of more than 300 pages of police reports that were so heavily redacted that they were substantively illegible. And as a result of that, we returned to court on June 18th seeking some direction from the court that they would have to provide the information in an unredacted form. And that has led to this controversy with City Council coming forward with a document called a Will of Council urging the Police Review Board to slow down its inquiry and to accept the schedule in those federal court suits that you mentioned, Heidi, that they accept the discovery schedule as the board's schedule of receiving documentation.
Why is it important that the review board see these documents sooner than the regular court schedule you just mentioned?
Well, the board has absolutely nothing to do with any of those other actions. The board is an independent, created to review police policies, procedures, conduct, whatever affects the relationship between the City of Pittsburgh Police and the citizens of the city and visitors to the city. And so their review is completely independent of any other entity's review. Now, what has happened in this situation, though, the issue of the G20 specific documents is really the vehicle that the city has now created to challenge the board's right of access to any documents, which would then affect the board's ability to conduct their individual investigations of police complaints as well as the general inquiries into police policies and procedures, the systemic issues. So it now is become an issue of, you know, does the city have the right to tell the independent review board when, what, and where they will receive information?
Let's take a step back and find out how you derive your power. Was it through a city charter that the review board was created?
Yes, the city attempted through legislative measures to create a civilian oversight mechanism. And the council body at the time was unable to accomplish that. And the citizens of the city took it onto themselves to create a referendum question that was posed to the people in May of 1997. And that passed overwhelmingly and resulted in an amendment to the Home Rule Charter. And that gave the power to the board to be independent and conduct impartial, objective investigations.
Beyond subpoena power, what other powers do you have?
They have the power to conduct public hearings, and that is significant because it allows the public to observe the finding of facts related to complaints involving police conduct and individual civilians that may have had a question about how that encounter occurred. Ordinarily, those things do not, people don't have the opportunity to observe the discussion of those incidents and a resolution towards either policy matters or issues that might generate more responsible citizenship decisions, so that it really creates a living opportunity for people to engage in that part of our community life that they never had before.
In the past, have you had this kind of resistance from the city council and others in charge?
We have had a history of resistance with the executive branch of the city of Pittsburgh's government, yes. But the board has always approached those disputes through the courts so that we can resolve it civilly. We don't have to get into situations that can be negative and destructive. We have mostly dealt with issues of resistance around the subpoenas, and those subpoenas have consistently been enforced by the courts, and so the issues have been resolved.
Going back to the G20, I was there. I saw you there. The National Lawyers Guild has had legal observers out on the streets. We saw the first use of the long-range acoustic device. We saw a lot of officers with canine units. How would you rate the police use of force and their overall response compared to what you had anticipated at that event?
I think that, you know, generally we were very, very fortunate, and it speaks well of the overall event here, because no one was killed, no one was injured to the extent of permanent damage to any function. I think overall it was okay in terms of the outcome to individuals physically. I think that we have a lot of questions, though, about the use of the LRAD being the first time ever deployed for domestic crowd control and public order purposes. There's no record here for us to compare to the use of the LRAD in other venues. It's the first time. So as a society, we have the opportunity to look and see how was it used and is it really an appropriate tool for use in American venues. The OC Vapor was also another tool that was not previously used.
Can you explain what OC Vapor is for listeners?
Pepper spray vapor, as opposed to the usual streaming pepper spray that people are accustomed to. It's a vaporized form. And what they did in Pittsburgh was they used intermittent rounds of smoke and OC vapor, which you can't see, but you certainly have a physical reaction to if you're exposed to it. It was an intermittent reinforcement to the protesters or the whoever was on the street that the police were trying to control. They didn't know whether they were going to be hit with smoke or with pepper spray or OC vapor, I'm sorry, or both. It was a way of managing public order that was unusual and worthy of some evaluation. And not necessarily for finding blame or pointing a finger, but for the purpose of understanding what those tools of force do, what the response to those tools of force are, and whether we as a people want to adopt them in the regular course of business for crowd control in America.
Beth, this raises, and I think this ties together what you were speaking about earlier, to me, the importance and the critical role that a review board such as yours has to do is, as you say, not necessarily to focus on attribution of blame, but to analyze the use of new tactics, the use of how the response, crowd control response to kind of unique situation that you had with the G20 summit, but that informs how police may respond in the future. And I see this as a public education duty that you have to analyze, provide your reports, and comment on this. And I know that across the country, all civilian review boards are quite different in form. One thing that many of them have in common is that there's resistance either by the city council, by the police unions, by the police department. But it would seem that it would benefit the police department to have you as sort of a partner in information to point out where they might want to change policies in the future.
And similarly to be a vehicle of explanation to the public as to why the police utilized certain tactics as they did, so that we could arrive at that mutually informed relationship between the police and the citizens. Our fact-finding into this, towards that analysis that you describe, has been impeded by this whole situation of the withholding of the documents or the provision of documents that are illegible for information. I do know for a fact that this board has not come to any conclusion with regard to police conduct during the G20, simply because they have not been able to evaluate all the information.
Let me just raise a question. We read in news reports last week that there was a possibility that several of your board members were going to be asked to leave by the City Council. Is that accurate?
We were in the middle of a court hearing. We were appearing before the judge in arguments about the provision of the documents that were at issue in the subpoena enforcement. And while we were there, the mayor of the City of Pittsburgh issued a press release announcing that he had intended to replace 5 of the board members.
And how many total members do you have?
7.
So it's a majority.
Yes. While it is true that the individuals on the board, the incumbents, their terms have expired, that does not equate to a vacancy. And what we learned, looking at the city code and the charter, there are no procedures in Pittsburgh to handle vacancies. It's not defined. And there are no procedures to handle term expirations, so that the people who are sworn to uphold the city code, and that code directs them to stay seated in an appointment until such time as their successor is appointed, are almost stuck because there's no procedure to move them out and move other people in. And in this situation, some of those members' terms had expired in 2007. They continued to serve as required by the law, and dutifully so. And then on Friday, the mayor suddenly decides that it's time for them to be moved on and submits a resolution to the City Council. Well, City Council, who does have the privilege of designating nominees for 4 of the seats, then has received a resolution that's predicated on an invalid process. So we're moving towards a concern that we may have a legitimacy question, whether the individuals who may be appointed through a council proceeding predicated on an invalid process, will they be the real board? Or will the incumbents who continue to serve until such time as their successors are validly appointed be the real board?
The mayor has claimed that his nomination of new members has nothing to do with the board's actions regarding the G20 protests. How do you respond to that?
Oh, I would find that to be a bit disingenuous. When you have a board in front of a judge arguing about a matter that everyone knows is very controversial and contrary to what the city's will is, and you move to replace them, it looks exactly as what it is.
How has the City Council responded to the mayor's plans?
Well, unfortunately, it has deteriorated into a very negative, destructive situation. Council members who may or may not believe they were moving forward with something appropriately, now faced with the situation that there really is no process to do what they attempted to do, then their effort to quiet the board and slow the board down with their will of council a week or so ago, it's all come together as an extraordinarily unpleasant time for council, for the community, and for the issue. But it results in the board essentially being under attack by people who either don't fully understand what the issues are or, for some other reason, wish to undermine and obstruct the continuation of the board's work, and all being done in absence of any procedure to properly assure the continuity and consistency of the board. So it's a terribly unfortunate situation that's come about, and I don't know what can happen next.
That was going to be my next question. Has there been public support? I know that among activists and people who are concerned about police accountability must be troubled by this recent set of developments.
The day after council received the resolution with the nominees that the mayor submitted to replace the incumbents on the Citizen Police Review Board, a group of community activists did come together. There was a press conference. They expressed their concern about the validity of the process that was implemented and certainly the appearance that it was intentionally directed to interfere with the G20 proceedings. There have been letters to the editor in local newspapers. There have been appearances before city council's meetings to express concern about what's going on. So it's beginning to develop. People are becoming aware of what's going on, what's at risk, and they're determining for themselves, you know, what's the true motivation behind it all. So it's premature to forecast where it may end up in terms of the community, but they are certainly becoming aware of it and expressing concern.
And Beth, how long have you been the executive director?
I've been with the Citizen Police Review Board since June of 1999.
And when did it officially start?
They were impaneled in December of 1997 and started receiving complaints in July of 98.
So were you the first executive director or the second?
No, actually, they did have a person who was their inaugural executive director and left probably 9 months into the organizational development.
Well, you have probably one of the most difficult jobs in the country, and we applaud you for your staying power and I think what I've observed to be a wonderfully fair way of dealing with a lot of individuals from different points of views. It's never an easy job. We at the National Lawyers Guild and our listeners at Law and Disorder, you know, are looking forward to following both the disposition of the cases that arose out of the G20 summit, but now we're especially concerned about this development, and we really appreciate your talking with us. Is there anything else that you'd like to add?
No, Heidi, I would very much like to thank you and the National Lawyers Guild for being here with us in Pittsburgh in September and for participating with us in the post-agenda meeting that we had at City Council in July. As you recall, your expertise was critical in forming the situation for City Council and encouraging that the event be appropriately managed and that there be an integration of interests and liaisons developed between all the parties. Now, much of that advice went unheeded, but we deeply appreciated your coming here and sharing your advice with us. And I really, really admire all that you're doing on behalf of the civil liberties of the people in this country.
Beth, thank you. And we will stay in touch because we want to find out what happens in this case. So we hope to talk with you again soon.
Thank you, Heidi.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Senator Joe Lieberman and Senator Susan Collins have the attention of civil liberties and privacy experts as they craft a bill that would allow the takeover of the civilian internet network during an emergency. After initial outcry, Senator Lieberman told the media that the Internet kill switch bill is a matter of national security, and a kill switch is needed to disconnect immediately from a foreign nation in case of an attack. He continued, quote, "Right now, China, the government, can disconnect parts of its internet in a case of war. We need to have that here, too." Protecting Cyberspace as a National Asset Act of 2010 is the name of the bill, and supporters argue that it is not a kill switch, but a way to divert traffic away from another country. It is added that the president already has broad powers to shut off any and all regulated telecommunications in the 1934 Telecommunications Act. To get more detail on the bill, we're joined today by Tracy Rosenberg, Executive Director of the Media Alliance. Welcome, Tracy, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi. It's great to be here.
We're hearing a lot of chatter about this recent bill that Senator Lieberman and Susan Collins have introduced, the kill switch bill, as we're calling it. Many people are concerned about provisions of the bill that would allow the president to shut down parts of the internet. Should we be concerned about this?
I think we should, honestly. The way that the bill is written, and of course, bills that are written to give presidents emergency powers are generally written extremely broadly, and that's exactly the situation with this bill. Potentially, a president could shut down the entire internet for 30-plus days under this bill. Potentially, every internet company could be required to share information about its users, its hits, IP addresses, with this new NCCC, which is National Center for Cybersecurity and something. So potentially, depending how it's enforced, there is tremendous latitude here for a number of really serious civil liberties violations. The closest parallel I can come up with is the War Powers Act, which is also a situation where potentially the military can be used by the president for a short period of time, pretty much at his or her sole discretion.
There's Section 18.4 that specifically says the president can declare a cyberspace emergency, as you said, and order the limitation or shutdown of internet traffic from any compromised federal government. So that would be another country. Or U.S. critical infrastructure system or network. Now, can you describe what an infrastructure system or network is?
Basically, what that's applying to is that it basically is trying to draw a parameter between the kinds of things the president can shut down and the kinds of things that he can't. That said, things like basic search functions are defined as part of the core infrastructure of the internet. And as many of us know, the way that we access information is via Google or Yahoo or web crawler. And these sorts of basic services potentially could be wrapped up in a definition like infrastructure.
Would things like our power grid or, you know, electricity, those kinds of systems be involved at all?
Potentially they could be. And this is one of the areas of the bill that needs a little bit of clarification. It can also affect landline telephone services. It can affect a huge amount of physical infrastructure.
One of the things that we've covered and have been obviously concerned about since the events of 9/11 has been the government's increasing gathering of personal data, targeting of people of specific political viewpoints. Would this implicate that, in your opinion, to any extent? For example, could the president target political groups whose opinions he feels might be unsavory and shut down their communications? Say the National Lawyers Guild and our membership around the country, our chapters.
For example, yes, I think it's clear that the way the bill is currently written, a president could do that. We're assured that that's not the intent of the bill. That doesn't mean that it couldn't be used in that fashion. The information sharing is quite similar to what happened during 9/11 and shortly afterwards. In other words, it potentially creates a situation where corporate providers basically rat out parties at the instructions of the government, and that could certainly be directed towards political viewpoints that a future presidential administration was not comfortable with. Internet sites could be forcibly shut down. Information about who's posting to them, who's reading them, and who's responsible for them and who owns them will become the property of the federal government.
As I understand it, there are essentially two keys, the theory goes, towards self-defense. One is to prevent the enemy from communicating, and the other is to protect our own vulnerabilities. And it would seem, as you said, that this law, as it is, would give unfettered room to the federal government to make determinations of when those come up. And so that in addition to the scenarios we've just mentioned, I can not even think of the possibilities of what could be shut down.
Yes. Like the War Powers Act, we are looking at a period of 30 days when there are no checks and balances. So these judgments are left in the hands of federal agencies, period. After 30 days, there is some ability for some sort of check and balance process in terms of the assessments and the judgments that have been made. But we really are very much in a Wild West for the period of time that the bill authorizes direct executive action. I think there's also a third motivating factor behind the bill that hasn't really been talked about, and that is litigation protection or liability protection for internet companies in the event of some sort of cyber attack incident. That hasn't been mentioned, but the bill also protects all of the internet companies from any liability whatsoever for interruption of service, economic catastrophe, and negative consequences that happen because people are not able to use the internet.
that we can't sue for interruption of service and whatever negative consequences that might have on our business or lives.
On our business, on our lives, on our emergency communications with each other, none of it. They are entirely protected. I think that's a huge motivating factor behind the bill. I think it's a reason why a humongous amount of internet providers are not out there fighting this.
Oh, that's interesting.
And yeah, I think it's something that needs to be talked about and hasn't been talked about, because there's questions of, yes, corporate profits are important. Are they more important than the rights of individuals and communities to get information that they need, especially in times of emergency, really when we most depend on the internet?
Exactly. And as we've seen them turning over personal information to the government, I would imagine that this would give them even more incentive to cooperate.
It looks like it probably would. That's definitely the way the incentives are being set up. And as we know, after 9/11, there were serious problems with what occurred. There were serious civil liberty violations that occurred. I don't see any reason why, in a post-cyber attack environment, we wouldn't see the same or possibly worse.
We noted that Lieberman said, and I'm quoting, "Right now, China, the government, can disconnect parts of its internet in a case of war. We need to have that here, too." And I think for many of us, when we hear that, we think of a great restriction on rights that we've been accustomed to in a democracy.
That wasn't the best bit of PR he ever did. I don't think he thought through that very well. But that said, yes, I mean, internet use in China is considerably compromised compared to what we enjoy here. And I think for most Americans, it would be quite shocking to have it here.
Tracy, you're the executive director of Media Alliance. Can you tell us a bit about what you do?
Sure. We started off as an association of journalists and have really become more of an association of people who are concerned about media and the communication system. What we try to do is support independent and alternative media and try to hold the mainstream accountable for their impact on communities and for making the communication system work a bit more as a two-way model rather than just a one-way model.
And do you have a website?
Yes, we do. It's our name, media-alliance.org, that's media-alliance.org.
Tracy, it's been so wonderful that you're able to take a few minutes out from the World Social Forum. This is a topic that I think will be of increasing interest to us as we learn more about it, and we hope to have you back on in a few months.
That would be great. Thank you so much, Heidi, for the opportunity to talk about this very important bill. And I'm a big fan of Law and Disorder. It was a pleasure to be here today.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Last week, the Supreme Court handed down a decision in the case of Holder v. Humanitarian Law Project. The decision was the court's first ruling on the free speech and association right of Americans in the context of terrorism since the September 11 attacks. The decision could have serious impact on lawyers, journalists, and academics who represent or who study terrorist groups. The case originated when the Humanitarian Law Project, whose mission is, quote, the peaceful resolution of conflict by using established international human rights laws and humanitarian law, challenged the vague law that prohibits material support to groups classified as terrorist by the U.S. government. The Humanitarian Law Project sought to provide advice to two terrorist groups on how to peacefully resolve their disputes using the United Nations and international law. The Supreme Court ruled that such assistance amounts to aiding terrorism. We're joined by Shane Kadidal from the Center for Constitutional Rights to clarify what forms and limits of assistance and material support are considered illegal to lawyers, journalists, and researchers. Welcome back to Law and Disorder, Shane.
Thanks for having me.
Let's first start by asking, were you surprised with the Supreme Court's decision last week?
I was. You know, in the lower courts, six times since 1998, we had won. The court's saying essentially that the material support statute was worded so broadly that it would, you know, allow not only sort of the government to prosecute people for simply talking to groups on the foreign terrorist organization list to try to dissuade them from violence, but that it would also allow the government to sort of selectively prosecute people. That raised all sorts of concerns about politically motivated prosecutions. You know, the oral argument had gone pretty well, we thought, and I think the, you know, number of the justices seemed very skeptical about the ways in which this law might be applied to journalists, to lawyers representing unpopular clients. But instead, we got 6-3 decision losing Justice Stevens, essentially saying for the first time ever that speech discouraging violence can be banned under the First Amendment.
A number of people were surprised, as you mentioned, a few of the justices included, at one example that was raised, and that would be the providing, the writing of an amicus or friend of the court brief by lawyers. What implication do you think that may have on lawyers who are currently defending people accused of terrorist crimes, say the Guantanamo attorneys?
Well, you know what, Solicitor General Kagan, who's going to join the Supreme Court shortly, said in response to these questions was, you know, first the justices asked whether you could submit an amicus brief in a case, say, you know, where a group was arguing that it didn't even belong on the terrorism list in the first place. Could an outsider come in and say, yes, we agree with that? Kagan said, well, absolutely, that's the kind of thing that can be banned under this. And so the justices kept asking questions, and they kind of got to the point of asking about, you know, whether or not you're even entitled as a lawyer to represent someone who's, you know, a member of a group that's on this FTO list, the Foreign Terrorist Organization list. And what Kagan said was pretty interesting. She said, if you have, you know, some sort of constitutional right to be in federal court in the first place, then yes, you know, we think the statute should be interpreted to allow that kind of, you know, a lawyer to represent someone in those circumstances. So a criminal defendant has a Sixth Amendment right to be in federal court, right, to mount a defense. They're entitled to a lawyer. If you had some clear due process right under the Constitution, you could try to vindicate that right by hiring a lawyer to sue for you. But when you think about it, you know, the Guantanamo litigation, it took us 7 years to establish that there was a constitutional right to challenge your detention if you're a non-citizen held in a place like Guantanamo outside of the 50 states. And so, you know, what Kagan was saying, yes, you know, at the oral argument in February is really that that lawyers were taking their chances when they decided to represent Guantanamo detainees in the first place.
Liz Cheney's group, Keep America Safe, has been claiming that lawyers who represent terrorists are, in her words, coddling or abetting them, a position that has been controversial even among some former Bush administration officials. But the court seems to be upholding that position in some senses.
Whether or not you could represent people in court or, you know, form an attorney-client relationship with someone even pro bono without getting paid, that wasn't before the court, and the court took some pains to say that it was kind of narrowly deciding this case. But, you know, what was before the court was really the, you know, the ability of humanitarian organizations to go talk to terrorist groups and say, look, you know, here are some peaceful ways to resolve your political disputes, to train them in human rights enforcement, to dissuade them essentially from violence. One of the nice examples that we had heard over the 12 years of litigating this case was that, you know, there was a longstanding civil war in Sri Lanka, and the Tamil Tigers controlled about half the country, but were put on the FTO list. And, you know, the dispute was about sort of, you know, people speaking, you know, different languages and different religious groups and typical sort of federalism stuff, right? And some people in the leadership of the Tamil Tigers had wanted to get books on federalism from people in the U.S., and that's the kind of thing that you can't do You couldn't send them books talking about how a democracy tries to govern an area where there are lots of different sort of splintered ethnic groups. It's a terrible sort of thing. That doesn't even get to stuff that isn't speech, the humanitarian aid. So again, for instance, a lot of our plaintiffs were Tamil American physicians groups, who wanted to go do infrastructure reconstruction, deliver their own medical services, go work with the sick and wounded in the areas of Sri Lanka that were ravaged by the civil war and then by the tsunami in 2004, but were controlled by the Tamil Tigers as the de facto government for decades in that area, and they couldn't do that sort of thing. You know, imagine if after the Haiti earthquake, all the American doctors who went down there to work on the thousands of wounded couldn't go, had to worry about whether or not dealing with the Haitian government would be, something that would, land them in jail for 15 years.
How are people to know going forward if work like that that they may want to embark on may be prohibited?
Well, the Supreme Court decided this case mostly addressing the question of whether or not the government had a sufficient justification to ban what was, otherwise pure political speech. But the lower courts dealt with the vagueness question, which is simply this, the law defines material support to be much more than, just sort of tangible things like guns or money, but also things like your own personal services or expert advice or assistance. And those terms are so broad that, again, it raises not only a sort of notice question, whether or not ordinary people would understand that services applies to something benign like, treating a wounded person with your medical skills, but also it raises the specter of prosecutors using their discretion to single out people for prosecution based on their political views. And so, and that's one of the fundamental problems with vague statutes. They just give too much discretion to law enforcement. If everything is prohibited, then law enforcement is going to be selective about, who they choose to prosecute. And that's a huge problem here, but the government likes that. I mean, they have used the designation power very selectively as well. It's very easy to put a group on these terrorism watch lists. Greenpeace would probably easily qualify. You don't have to engage in sort of terrorism the way we think of it. Anything that causes economic damage to the U.S. and involves the use of a weapon can land you on the list. It's been used very selectively as a tool of diplomacy. So, for instance, when President Clinton, under his administration, this power was first created, and he was the first person to sort of come up with the idea of using embargo powers that typically had been, directed at whole nations against whom the U.S. was at war, like, Nazi Germany or the Cuba embargo was sort of an example, and instead directing them at political organizations. It was intended to, sort of give us some leverage. You'd give the U.S. government leverage over various Palestinian groups to sort of drag them to the negotiating table. And it's morphed into what we have now, where all sorts of politically unpopular groups that might not really meet anyone's definition of terrorist organization are on the list.
Shane, correct me if I'm wrong, but I seem to remember during oral arguments that a distinction was made by Kagan that it was actually okay to be a member. Membership of one of these organizations on the FTO list was okay, but providing support wasn't. How do you reconcile that?
Well, it's a little bit like those Communist Party cases where the court talks about sort of nominal membership as opposed to active membership, and simply declaring that you have sympathies, that you're a member in that sense isn't going to be a problem. Now, there were a whole slew of cases in the 1950s where the federal government tried to criminalize belonging to the Communist Party, and the Supreme Court said no, just because this party engages in both political acts and some sort of violence. In fact, the government claimed that the Communist Party engaged in terrorism. It was an international organization and had sleeper cells inside the United States. And the Supreme Court said, notwithstanding all of that, you can't sort of criminally punish someone simply for joining a group that engages in some illegal activity. Instead, they have to join with the intent to further that criminal activity. And that's something that we argued in this case, that ought to be a limiting principle. And actually, the three justices in dissent, Breyer, Ginsburg, and Sotomayor, all said that they would have adopted that reading in order to save the statute, and that would have given some comfort to our clients, who obviously don't have the intent to further the illegal ends of any of these groups that they want to deal with. They want to instead convince them to turn away from violence and unlawful activity.
And on the dissent, was there anything that surprised you in there?
That was a pretty strong dissent, actually, from Breyer. Maybe that's what surprised me, given the author. We did lose John Paul Stevens, though, with the majority, which is very distressing. This will be one of his last opinions, or really one of the last votes, I suppose, he casts.
What is the center, if anything, going to do in the wake of this unfortunate news?
Well, it's always a little bit of a shock when after 12 years you finally realize that a case is more or less at the final stage. I think there's a little bit of activity that will happen in the lower courts, but by and large, I think our appeal here is going to be to history and to Congress. And there are there's a large coalition of groups that are trying to get Congress to not only exempt the sort of speech that our plaintiffs wanted to engage in, but also humanitarian aid in crisis zones, you know, to make it sort of possible for doctors to stream into Sri Lanka after the tsunami in the way that they'd streamed into Haiti after the earthquake. So there'll be proposals like that put before Congress, and Congress is what it is, but, you know, we do have a supposedly progressive president with pretty huge majority, so we'll see if anything changes. You know, but it is always helpful when you go hat in hand to Congress to be able to say, well, the courts have found this this statute problematic, and for 12 years we had a number of lower court decisions where we could say that, and now we don't.
How will this decision affect your future work?
Well, I think it's definitely a concern in terms of that question that we talked about in terms of legal representation of clients, who are trying to establish that they have constitutional rights. So, you know, it's one thing if it's very clear that you have a constitutional right, if you have a clear due process right, or if you're a criminal defendant. But if you're some sort of civil plaintiff, you know, coming in trying to challenge some actions of the United States outside of its own territory. Which is exactly what we've done over and over again since 9/11, really, is try to say that the Constitution limits the executive's powers and its, counterterrorism measures. Those kind of cases are going to be very difficult to bring, or they'll at least raise questions that will have to be seriously addressed by lawyers. And again, unless Congress decides to exempt legal representation in those sort of circumstances, which is something that it should do.
Shane, let's put this in the bigger context. Did this case arise out of the Patriot Act?
Was created under President Clinton, under AEDPA, the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act, in 1996. You know, and again, it was created in large part to bring, to give the president, a stick with which to sort of force various Palestinian groups to the table by putting them on the banned list. So Hamas, for instance, is on the FTO list. But what happened was that we brought our lawsuit 2 years later in 1998, and we won repeatedly in the lower courts, and the court said that the statute was just, overly vague. And so Congress returned to the statute several times and tried to modify it in a way that they thought would make it less vague. But every time they narrowed down, one provision, so for instance, the personnel provision, you can't provide yourself as personnel. So a doctor going into a crisis zone would be providing himself as personnel to the Tamil Tigers or something like that, right? But there's an exemption that Congress put in saying that you're only serving as personnel if you're acting sort of at the command and control of one of these groups, direction and control, right? But at the same time that Congress was pulling back with narrowing those kind of provisions, they added other open-ended provisions. So they added the term services several years into the litigation. And that, of course, is open-ended enough to subsume all the other terms, personnel, training, expert advice, you name it. So it's been kind of one step forward and two steps back every time Congress has returned to try to modify the statute. But yes, one of the last times that Congress took a shot at that was with the Patriot Act. So this case was technically the first case heard by the Supreme Court that that challenged a provision of the Patriot Act.
Are you familiar with other pending cases that might follow this?
The court indicated a little bit, I think, in parts of its decision that it doesn't really want to see these kind of pre-enforcement challenges brought. This case was brought by, our clients, humanitarian groups, who were worried that they could get prosecuted if they did what they were planning to do. So they said to the court, here's what we're planning to do, and we want you to come and tell the government that they can't prosecute us. That way we'll be safe to go and do it. Right. I think most of the cases that you see are going to be cases involving criminal prosecutions under the material support statute. And the government generally hasn't tried to push super hard, to stop people from merely speaking to groups. But obviously journalists and lawyers and the like and humanitarian groups, those groups all have lawyers and they're all very cautious about these sort of things. And so the chilling effect is really the biggest problem with clients like ours and lawyers and journalists. The New York Times and Washington Post published editorials by Hamas leaders 3 years ago. That kind of thing, I think they have to wonder now whether or not, the zeitgeist has swung against them. Technically, I don't see why it wouldn't be illegal to do that. But, there will be a lot of criminal cases where this statute at the margins gets tested. This is one of the most popular sort of charges for the government to bring against in terrorism cases against defendants. They've used it over 150 times since 9/11, and they reported in their brief that they had 75 convictions, which actually is astonishingly low as a conviction rate. And I think what that tells you is that the government uses it in the cases where it has the weakest evidence. You know, and that makes sense because all the government has to prove is that somebody gave some form of support. You know, it could be as nebulous as quote unquote services to an organization that's on the list, and that they knew the organization was on the list. They don't have to show that you had the intent to further the criminal ends of the organization. So writing a check to Hamas to go to an orphanage or some of their other social service activities, that, you know, is just as bad as writing a check that is used to buy suicide bombing belts or something like that.
Shane, do you think we're going to see this applied retroactively to cases that might not have aroused the suspicion of anyone?
Well, I mean, it's got a very long statute of limitations, 8 years as opposed to the usual 5 years. So the government, you know, will be able to use it, especially if they charge it in conjunction with sort of conspiracy charges. Then there's almost no real practical time limitation on it. But it's already the most popular thing they use. So almost everybody at Guantanamo in the military commissions, with two exceptions, every single charge sheet contains the charge of material support. You know, and again, it's because you don't have to show intent. All you have to do is show the person knew that the group that they were giving some form of nebulous services to was on the list. You don't have to show that they had, sort of a malicious intent of any sort. That makes it very easy for prosecutors, and they love that.
The list is on the internet, correct? The FTO list?
Yeah, the FTO list itself is somewhat short. I mean, it's a little less than 4 dozen groups, but there are all sorts of other parallel sanctions regimes, some of which we had challenged in the lower courts, and those cases were waiting the decision in HLP from the Supreme Court. So if you look at the full sanctions list, it's about 450 pages of single-spaced, three-column text that you can pull up on the Department of Treasury website. So it really is, enormous. And so the more broadly the government says, groups dealing with groups on the list can be punished, the more of a problem it becomes in terms of that chilling effect. I'll give you some examples. I mean, we had journalists come to us who said they wanted to write sympathetic stories about a certain group that's on the list, and they were going to be at an international conference where members of the group were going to be there. Now, can somebody like that talk to the leadership of the group and try to plumb whether or not they think it's a good idea to write a sympathetic story at this time, even without explaining what the journalist was doing? Well, I think it's all very murky at this point.
Meaning that a sympathetic article could be construed to be an endorsement of that group's efforts.
Well, it could be construed as being some, that sort of communication might be problematic. The actual publishing the article could be construed as a service, providing yourself as personnel, right? I mean, it's interesting. The Supreme Court said, and Hagen said while arguing the case, that independent advocacy was not something that could be punished. So you can say whatever you want, fully independent of a group. You can say it is great that Hamas blows up school buses or something like that, as long as you're not saying it to the organization, to members of the organization. Once you start communicating with them, even if you're saying you guys should really, turn away from violence, it's the wrong strategy, here's how you can bring complaints to the United Nations, et cetera, which is the sort of thing that our plaintiffs wanted to do. The fact that it's coordinated with members of the group, that you're speaking to them, that's what makes it illegal, according to the Supreme Court and according to Solicitor General Kagan. So that produces all sorts of paradoxical examples like the one I just gave you. And there are other oddball things, too. I mean, there is no exemption for, humanitarian relief, things like food or medicine, for an earthquake or something like that. But there is an exemption for religious materials. You can imagine why that sort of thing would be put in there, given the political climate the last 15 years. So you can donate an unlimited amount of religious materials that advocate terrorism and violence to members of a banned group, but you can't send them, a book on federalism.
Or medicine. Shane, this is fascinating. We're really sorry about the outcome of the decision. We know how hard you and many other people, it was a great effort from CCR and many attorneys, but it was, as always, a pleasure to have you telling us a bit more about it from the inside. And we hope to talk to you again soon.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Shane.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.